It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Congress is on recess this week, but when they get back, they'll have only 2 days to come to an agreement on a budget resolution. We'll hear what's at stake in our weekly look at Capitol Hill.
First, we're talking about the latest news on a possible new arena for the Bucks in Milwaukee. Team officials held a press conference this morning where they laid out plans for a new development package that includes a new arena and a public plaza that will cost a total of $1 billion.
Don Walker has been following the debate over the Bucks arena. He was at the press conference this morning. He's a Marquette University fellow writing about this whole arena plan for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Don, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
Well, paint us a picture. What did the Bucks unveil today at this press conference?
Well, they, for those who attended, they showed three rather large renderings taken at sort of different angles of what this new arena could look like. And for comparison purposes, it's approximately 700,000 square feet, which is about 200,000 square feet larger or bigger than the BMO Harris Bradley Center. In addition, these renderings showed what could be in the offing over the next 10 or 12 years, and that is a fair amount of new, what they call ancillary development in and around the arena, such things as perhaps a hotel, retail, commercial, office space, etc. Much of this hoped for new development, which they anticipate could be valued by as much as $500 million, would be located in what has been largely vacant land in the city of Milwaukee since 1999, known locally as the Park East Corridor. So a very ambitious plan. The Bucks president, Peter Fagan, spoke at length about what this was all about, starting a conversation in the community about getting this arena approved, and then we heard from a couple of the architects who had a hand in the design of the new arena.
And then the price tag on the arena that's been going around has been in the $500 million neighborhood. I was a little surprised when I saw a billion-dollar plan this morning, but the price of the arena itself did not double this morning, right?
That is correct. The arena, give or take, is expected to cost about $500 million. The extra $500 million referred to is, again, the anticipated additional development that they believe will spin off once the new arena is completed. One of the wrinkles or surprises that the Bucks released is their intention to build their own training facility not all that far from the new arena site. Currently, the Bucks have their training facility at the Archbishop Cousins Center in suburban St. Francis along Lake Michigan.
So with this above and beyond, not just the arena sports entertainment facility they have here, but this idea of what could be this extra $500 million of potential development, is this part of an effort to sell this project to policymakers who need to sign off on portions of the funding?
Yeah, I think so very much. But having said that, there is some evidence across the country in various American cities where developers and professional sports franchises have banded together to put together projects in which there is an arena or a stadium in some cases that is sort of merged or developed at the same time with additional ancillary development in the form of office space, even housing, commercial office space, restaurants, bars, etc. A couple of examples, there is a development in Los Angeles called LA Live, which is near the Staples Center. There's one in Kansas City. There's one in the city of Columbus called the Arena District. So this has been going on in some American cities with some measure of success. Not everyone is necessarily on board with this approach, but most sports economists that I've spoken to say that the chances of these kinds of projects succeeding are increased when it's when there's something more than just an arena to look at. The days of just building an arena and putting a bunch of parking lots around it are pretty much gone.
Talking to Don Walker about plans for the new Milwaukee Bucks arena and related development released this morning at a press conference. Well, the big question, this one that's been going on for a while now, including in the governor's budget, how will this arena package be funded?
Well, it's a huge question, of course, and what sort of happened today is, you know, for weeks we were hearing that various elected officials, both in Milwaukee and in Madison, were pressing the Bucks, well, tell us what the plan is so we have some sense of what how we can try to finance this. Well, lo and behold, the Bucks came through and provided some details today. But today, some elected officials are sort of turning the tables back on the city and the county and saying, we need you to do more in terms of providing more in contributions in order to put together an arena financing plan. Right now in Madison, the debate is over a plan that Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald is forging that would lower the amount of state bonding made available to this project. And, of course, that would put additional pressure on not just the city and the county, but the Bucks owners themselves to make up the difference.
Is there a sense that the Bucks owners and the local governments can and would make up the difference, the shortfall between what Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald is talking about and what the governor had initially proposed?
Well, I would say at this point, no. The city last week, Mayor Barrett held a news conference and detailed the city's $25 million plus contribution toward the project. We have not heard specific details from County Executive Chris Abley. But I think the city especially feels that it has already offered enough money, or at least money that they feel they can reasonably put into the pot in order to make this financing plan come together. The city, of course, has many other needs in addition to perhaps a new arena, and we could spend an entire show talking about that with high crime and in certain areas of the city, education needs, public safety, et cetera. So there's a great deal of pressure on the mayor, and the mayor has already stated publicly that he has no intention of raising property taxes to help fund this arena.
Well, and one point that some critics or partial supporters of the arena have been saying from the outset almost, it seems like, is, hey, if you're going to do this big athletic-related facility, let's take some of the money and put it into local parks, local athletic facilities for youth in the Milwaukee area. Is that something that is still being talked about? Is it entering into the discussion of the actual plan at all?
Well, it hasn't entered into the actual discussion of the plan, but what you're referring to is a community organization known as Common Ground, which has publicly stated that they are opposed to the use of any public money toward the construction of a new arena. They are pushing it back on two fronts. As you stated, they would like to see some money set aside to refurbish playgrounds and recreational spaces in Milwaukee County. But more recently, they have linked one of the Bucks owners, Wes Edens, to a company he has a financial interest in known as NationStar Mortgage, which is a very well-known and fast-growing mortgage servicing firm. Common Ground has argued that that firm is responsible for an undetermined number of blighted properties in the city of Milwaukee. And they're making the case that the city should never consider providing any money whatsoever toward a new arena until NationStar takes care of these blighted properties. So that is a debate. The day has is coming when that debate will be had on the floor of the Milwaukee's Common Council. But right now it has not directly figured into the arena plans.
So response to this arena all along, there's been some excitement, and we've heard some of that from business leaders in the area. There's been a lot of skepticism, including what you just outlined. Was the release of these plans this morning, do you think it's going to be enough of a wow factor to tip the balance in favor of this arena?
Well, it's funny you should use that word. When I was briefed on the plan and wrote about it for today's paper, Bucks officials, some of whom I spoke with, asked me if there was a wow factor here, and that is very important to them. It's important that public opinion, in their view, be favorable toward this new arena. I don't honestly know if it created a wow factor, but I can certainly say that it certainly created a great deal of public buzz today, people reading the story and taking stock of the renderings that were released by the team. So in that sense, I think they succeeded. But as always, the devil's in the details. Things will start turning toward what kind of arena financing plan there is and whether it has a chance of passing.
Don, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Don Walker, Marquette University Fellow, writing about the Bucks Arena proposal. He's been covering this for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
It's our weekly look at Congress. After a big announcement last Thursday that Iran and the world powers had reached a framework agreement, members of Congress have been weighing in. This week, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer challenged the White House, saying he wants Congress to have a say on any final agreement the Obama administration makes.
And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul threw his hat into the ring yesterday to compete for the Republican presidential nomination.
Paul Singer is out this week. His colleague Cooper Allen joins us. He's the politics and Congress editor at USA Today. Cooper, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Congress, now starting with Republicans, now an increasing number of Democrats, they want to have a say on this Iran nuke deal as it comes down the pike, and hence now we have this proposed bill that would give them that say, would give them authority. What do we know about what the bill says?
Well, we know it's got a lot of support, as you said, certainly among Republicans and an increasing number of Democrats. It would basically give Congress 60 days to review a final agreement, which would likely come in June, and it would prevent the Obama administration from withdrawing sanctions against Iran during that time while Congress reviews it. So the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is marking up the bill this Tuesday, April 14th, which is chaired by Bob Corker. So it's going to be interesting to see how many Democrats come on board and whether Republicans and supporters of the bill can get to that magic number in the Senate of 67, which would give them a veto-proof majority, which would effectively eliminate President Obama's option of killing the bill and would give Congress a lot of authority on this.
And of course, the president would like to kill that bill. What does the White House need to do if it wants to persuade Democrats not to get on board with it?
Well, the interesting thing about this is supporters of the bill have two really strong things going for them. One, the chief sponsor, the chairman of the committee, Bob Corker, is not a firebrand, really vituperative anti-Obama figure among congressional leaders. You know, President Obama today called him, and the White House has said positive things about him. So it might be easier for Democrats to feel comfortable challenging the president on this, knowing that the chief sponsor of the bill is not really someone who at least appears that he's trying to score political points. And the other thing, as you mentioned, Chuck Schumer has jumped on board, and Schumer was a prominent figure among Democrats already, but certainly in recent weeks, after this surprising news that Harry Reid was retiring, and Democrats quickly coalesced around Schumer as the next Senate Democratic leader when the next Congress convenes. So that's another reason why Democrats that may be wavering about whether they wanted to challenge President Obama, they might feel more comfortable knowing that their future leader in the Senate is on board with this. So the White House probably has a tough sales job ahead to keep enough Democrats from jumping to the other side on this.
Are there key Democrats that both supporters and the White House are watching to make sure to see whether they show signs of wavering and maybe being interested in supporting this bill?
Well, there are a couple of Democrats in recent days that it looked like they were going to support the bill, but now they're kind of hedging a little. Chris Coons in Delaware, Mark Warner from Virginia. If members like that start to indicate that they will support the White House on this, that could be a sign that supporters won't be able to get to 67 and a veto would be upheld. But we should know more on Tuesday when the committee marks it up to see just how much support they ultimately get in committee. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has indicated after the bill is approved by the committee that he'll likely bring it up fairly soon thereafter. So this process could play out pretty quickly.
Is there anything that the White House could do to assure Congress that it's being heard, that maybe without this bill, some of their considerations can be taken into account?
You know, that might take a member by member sales job for this, because there is a lot of there is an underlying desire among both parties that Congress just wants a say in this, regardless of whether you support the president or not. They want a say on such an important foreign policy matter. So whether the president has to give, you know, some concessions on sanctions or not, we'll see. You know, we only do at this point have a framework for an agreement. So there are still a lot of details to be worked out in the next couple of months with Iran and amongst the major powers who are negotiating this on the final details. So there may be some leeway where the White House can kind of assure wavering Democrats that they wouldn't be giving away too much. But it looks like it's going to be pretty close, you know, in a final vote.
We're talking with Cooper Allen from USA Today about the latest news from Congress. And yesterday, Rand Paul joined Ted Cruz as the second official contender for the Republican nomination. How did that announcement compare with Cruz's?
Well, it was a little more traditional in just sort of the stagecraft. Ted Cruz kind of walked the stage in Lynchburg. And also the location was more traditional. You know, Rand Paul did it from Louisville, his home state. Ted Cruz went to Virginia, which not only wasn't his home state, it wasn't even one of the early voting states like Iowa or New Hampshire. And interestingly enough, it looked like today we saw numbers that Cruz's announcement made a much bigger impact on Facebook. You know, we read into that what you will. That doesn't necessarily signal any long-term trends ahead, but so Paul's the latest, and we're expecting another one Monday evening when Marco Rubio has promised a big announcement in Miami. So that will bring to three the number of Republican senators who have officially announced. Lindsey Graham is also, you know, considered a possible candidate, though he's considered a tier below those three. So we'll see. Cruz and Paul will be competing for a lot of the same supporters, and Rubio. They all kind of came to the Senate since 2010 and 2012 with Cruz, with a lot of Tea Party support. So they're really going to have to jockey to kind of emerge as the favored candidate of the Tea Party in the months ahead.
Now, Rand Paul is considered a long shot. He's a libertarian-leaning candidate. But do fringe candidates like Paul have a decent shot of at least shaping the discourse as the primary unfolds?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious comparison for Paul is to his father, Ron, who ran in 2012 and 2008 and even in 1988 as a libertarian nominee. And Rand Paul is certainly considered a much more credible candidate than his father. He has broader appeal, and his foreign policy positions are more likely to be considered more mainstream than Ron Paul's, especially among more conservative Republican primary voters. So he can certainly, at the very least, shape the debate. And it wouldn't be surprising if he does gain some traction in states like New Hampshire, where he's polling reasonably well right now. So the key will be in a crowded field whether he can kind of emerge from this cluster of candidates who are all competing for the same ground. And we'll see. You know, the next few months will largely be about who can make headway in fundraising, and then in August and September, when the first debates start, we'll probably really start to see the contrasts and the battling amongst those Tea Party candidates kind of surface.
And before we let you go, we should talk about the confirmation of Attorney General nominee Loretta Lynch. Where is that process right now?
Yeah, that has gone on for much longer than certainly the White House would have preferred. So Loretta Lynch's nomination right now, first of all, it's if it were to come to a vote tomorrow or Monday, which it won't, it would be very close by all accounts. It may come down even to Vice President Biden's tie-breaking vote as president of the Senate. But the key now is just getting it to a vote. A human trafficking bill, which was thought to be not controversial at all, has been held up in the Senate over some abortion funding language that Democrats, when it first surfaced in committee, didn't even realize was in it. So now we're at an impasse over this human trafficking bill, which, until it gets resolved, Mitch McConnell has said he will not bring Loretta Lynch's nomination to a vote. So it's a lot of moving parts have to kind of be resolved before we can even get to a vote. And when we do, it looks to be a very tight one. So that's something that, you know, we don't really have a time frame for when that'll be resolved. But her nomination has been pending for a while now. So there will probably be increased pressure to kind of resolve this one way or another in the next few weeks.
Cooper, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Cooper Allen, politics and Congress editor at USA Today with the latest from Washington. Join us every Wednesday at this time for a look at the latest from Congress. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. April is National Donate Life Month, a time to bring awareness to organ donation in the United States and the need for more donors.
According to a recent report on that issue, there's still a significant gap between available organs and patients seeking a transplant. So why is that, and what's being done to try to close that gap here in Wisconsin?
In just a bit, we'll hear from a guest who will make the case for becoming an organ donor. First, we're joined by Nate Phelps. He's a reporter for Gannett and Wisconsin Media. He's been writing about organ donation here in the state. Nate, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm good. Well, let's start with some numbers here. How many people nationally are waiting for an organ transplant and here in Wisconsin, too?
Sure. Nationally, the number that I've been given in reporting has been about 123,000 people are in need of an organ. Statewide, it's about 2,300 people that are waiting for a transplant or in need of an organ at this point. And it's kind of funny today. I was working on some numbers as well, too, specifically for kidneys. I was working on a story that relates to kidney transplant. I just want to scroll down here real quick. Should have had it ready for me. I think for kidneys in 2013, there were about 16,895 transplants nationwide, with about a third of those organs coming from living donors. The rest were from deceased. And the Kidney Foundation, National Kidney Foundation, tells me there are about 102,000 Americans in need of a kidney. That's about 1,900 people in Wisconsin.
Now, here in the state, how many people on this list, people needing donations, will actually get a transplant while waiting for one?
I had some information on that. I can't quite come up with where I have it at this point yet. Some of the stuff is still fluid, and I'm still working on it. That one I don't have right in front of me at this point, and I don't know that I've run across that number just yet at this point from reporting in the past.
But generally, is there a sense that there's a gap, that we don't have enough transplants for the people who need them?
Yeah, that's right. And what you'll see is a lot of advocacy groups, different hospital organizations really put a push on this month to try to get the word out there that they are in need, that this gap exists. There are people on waiting lists. There are people that are dying while on the waiting list, or being subjected to continual degradation of their health and things along that lines. And we've talked to a couple people. I talked to a guy down in the Appleton area who has had a device in his heart, more or less a life support device, since late 2013 when he had a heart attack. And he's on that list, and he's hopeful that something will come through and come up for him. The people I've talked to that are actually waiting at this point say they tend to take it day by day and not look big picture, just because I think it would be it's kind of a daunting task when you look at it, at least what they tell me, when you look at it as this looming need that they have, and they just kind of take it day by day and take it as it comes.
Here in Wisconsin, who handles transplants? Who does these things? Who arranges them?
Sure. There are a number of organizations that kind of handle, getting organ donations set up and, tissue and blood type in eyes and various different types of tissue that can be donated, in many cases from deceased donors, but also from living donors. Frederick Hospital and Medical College down in Milwaukee is one of the performing agencies. Aurora St. Luke's, UW Medical or Transplant Program out of Madison there, and you've got Children's Hospital as well which is handling some of the actual physical hands-on transplants here in the state of Wisconsin. So there's really four major entities that are handling that. And on top of that, you know, Blood Center of Wisconsin operates what's known as the Wisconsin Donor Network, which provides some information, some coordination. There's the Wisconsin Department of Transportation as well. I mean, not that they're necessarily right involved in the donor process, you know, allows people to make that option to select donation when they renew their driver's license as well.
One of the challenges you write about is that even if you are signed up as a donor, it's not a sure thing that your organs will be usable when you die. How big a challenge is it to get enough organs, given that that's the case?
Yeah, you know, I think the number that I was told is that I think 1 to 2% of people that die in a manner that allow their organs to be used successfully in a transplant. So I think that's certainly a challenge. And even, you know, like I said, I've kind of been working on a story that involves kidneys, that's been on my mind today, and you know, I've been working with that a little bit. I was talking with someone from the National Kidney Foundation who says even getting matched donors from within the same family can be, you know, a difficult task. And we've got a story coming Sunday that kind of looks at one instance where, you know, there's an Oshkosh woman who was set to get a kidney transplant from her dad. Actually, it was supposed to happen today, and some late testing, some last-minute preoperative testing kind of brought to the surface that there was a risk of rejection. So she's now kind of put in the limbo of what happens next and where they go. But the family has some options. They've got friends and coworkers that have stepped up, and they continue to look. And she remains pretty positive about what the outcome will be, with her pending transplant at this point.
Talking to Nate Phelps, a reporter for Gannett Wisconsin Media, about organ transplants here in Wisconsin, the need for more donors, the challenges facing families, people needing these transplants. Nate, in your reporting, have you seen any medical advances that have allowed more organs to be usable than in the past?
Yeah, you know, one of the doctors at Frater, we talked briefly last week, and he talked a little bit about, specifically in terms of liver transplant, that there are ways that they can use a liver by taking portions of it or separating it into two, and, you know, using that in multiple multiple patients. So with what he was doing at Frederick, he's seen his numbers, the numbers of transplants that they've done go up as they've introduced some of these new techniques and things that they've been able to use. So, you know, the medical field continues to look at ways to, and they're very well aware of the gap. So, you know, they are trying to come up with both technology, you know, machine technology and, you know, surgical technology to, you know, maximize the availability of organs that are out there.
And now, Nate, in your reporting on this, what stories have you had from people about how organ donation touched their lives?
It's interesting that you mentioned that. This has been a story, surprisingly, that I think has resonated more than I thought it would. And I'm basing that on the number of phone calls and emails that I've had come in basically early this week, after some of this reporting ran over the weekend. And what I'm surprised with is people, both donors that may have had someone, you know, die either, in whatever capacity, will tell me how many different lives they were able to save by donating the organs, or, you know, kind of where some of the tissues and samples went. And, you know, in some cases, you know, it touches dozens, if not hundreds, of people that they're able to do this with. But I've been surprised at how much this story has resonated and how willing the people that have been involved either in getting a transplant or offering their organs for transplant are about talking about it. They're pretty passionate about getting out there and saying, look, this is a need. This is something that, is real. It exists. And, they'd like to draw some attention to it. From the advocacy side and the medical side, really kind of what they've put out there is, you know, this month being designated as the Donate Life Month, is they're encouraging people to take a look at the information. Is donation right for me? Kind of go online, educate yourself, see if this is something you want to be a part of. And the other thing, too, is talk to your family about it. I've heard this from a number of people involved in this, is the wishes of people are known amongst each other. If there's a case where something unexpectedly or tragic happens, a family member has the knowledge to make the decision to say, it makes it easier for the family to say, yeah, this was their wish to make a donation or whatever they wanted to do. Because, you know, obviously that's a pretty hard time with a lot going on, and having that conversation can sometimes help is kind of what I've been told.
Well, we're going to call her. Camille is on the line in Monona. Camille, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I'm sorry I didn't know about this program before listening about an hour ago. I had the pleasure of serving as special assistant to the secretary, Tommy Thompson, when he was the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which is the national public agency responsible for many aspects of organ donation. And because of his interest in this, basically by having someone, a surgeon from the University of Wisconsin Hospital, come to his house in the governor's mansion one night and saying, I'm not feeling so good because I lost a patient today. And so the governor said, well, tell me about it. And he immediately became very interested in what the governor's office could do to help promote the awareness of the need for donation, and as Nate said, the importance of talking to your family so that they know what your wishes are in the unfortunate situation that they should die, especially young people in, you know, accidents.
Camille, thanks a lot. A good Wisconsin angle. Nate, do you get a sense as we wrap up from people you talk to that Wisconsin is doing well on this issue, at least compared to the rest of the country?
You know, that's an interesting question. You know, I don't know that I've necessarily pursued it from that angle. You know, I certainly think, you know, the people I've talked to tend to think that, you know, this is a good time to get the word out and, you know, to let them know that there is a need here. I don't know how it compares to what's gone on nationally with some of the other organizations that undertake this in various other states. I'm going to be doing about 2 months' worth of reporting on this, so you may have just given me a story idea for something to come back to.
Well, watch for that, Nate. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
That's Nate Phelps, reporter for Gannett Wisconsin Media. In just a moment, we'll be joined by an advocate for organ donation. He'll make the case that we ought to sign up.
We're talking about organ donation here in Wisconsin. April is National Donate Life Month. In just a moment, we'll hear from an organ donation advocate. He'll make the case for signing up to be a donor.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have an organ donation story to share? Were you or a family member the recipient of an organ? Or if you've signed up to be a donor, what was behind your decision? What questions did you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Mike Anderson joins us now. He's director of University of Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin Organ and Tissue Donation Services. Mike, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So start us off. Make the case that someone should make sure they're signed up to become an organ donor.
Well, maybe I'll just reiterate what your previous guest said, and that is there are over 123,000 individuals throughout this country waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. And in Wisconsin alone, around 2,300 individuals that are waiting. I would also add that the number of deaths on the wait lists are going up. In fact, the latest statistic is about 21 individuals die every day throughout this country waiting for an organ.
So how do we do it? How do we make sure we're registered as an organ donor?
Yeah, the process really is quite simple. First and foremost is to really research the subject matter. Make sure that you as an individual have the facts about organ donation. That's number one. Number two, you need to document your decision, and you can go to yesiwillwisconsin.com and make your wishes known on the registry. And then third, most importantly, is to communicate your decision to your family that this is exactly what you want at the end of your life.
Now, while studying up here, I took a look at my driver's license. I have the orange dot. Is that, am I taken care of? Am I ready to be a donor if I have that there?
Yeah, an orange dot. It really depends on the date your license was issued. If a donor dot was placed on that license after March 29th of 2010, you are, in fact, a registered donor. What I would encourage anyone to do is to go to the website, yesiwillwisconsin.com, and sign up there on the website so that there is no question that you are a registered donor.
Well, you talked about knowing the facts about organ donation. Are there misconceptions about how this works that you think maybe sway people to not be donors?
Yeah. There's a number of misconceptions and myths around organ donation. Probably the main myth and misconception is that if I am brought into the hospital and I have a donor dot on my license, will the medical team do everything they can do to save my life? And the fact of the matter is, yes, they will. The team in emergency rooms, in our intensive care units, their first and primary responsibility is to do everything they can do to save your life. It is only after that's been determined that your life cannot be saved and that you're declared dead is only when our organization becomes involved and that we evaluate for suitability for organ donation.
So people, we've heard from people who are worried that, they might need my organs. They're not going to give it their all to save me if I'm in the emergency room. That's not the case, though.
That is not the case.
All right. Any other misconceptions that you come across a lot that might be an obstacle?
Yeah, another big misconception is around disfigurement. If I am a donor, will my body be disfigured? And the fact is, no, it will not. In fact, to do a organ recovery is making one incision similar to what you would get to have your appendix removed or a gallbladder removed. And of course, those incisions are concealed by clothing. So there is no disfigurement of the body following an organ donation.
We are talking to Mike Anderson, director of the University of Wisconsin Organ and Tissue Donation Services. You can join in if you have a story about an organ donation, a transplant that has affected your life. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We have Pat on the line in Madison. Pat, hi.
Good afternoon. I have a question about the difference between opt-in policies and opt-out policies. It's been shown in European countries when you have the sticker on the driver's license and then the individual can simply peel it off if they want to opt out, their donation rates are 2 or 3 times higher than if you have a blank license plate or a license, driver's license, and you have to actually put the sticker on. The effect is the same. You still have the choice. But what about a policy in Wisconsin where we would have the sticker on the driver's license, and you could peel it off if you wanted, you'd get 2 or 3 times as many people donating simply by just changing one policy.
Pat, thanks for the call. We have an opt-in policy here in the state. I don't know if this is in your control at all, Mike, but would it help? Would having an opt-out policy help?
Well, that was discussed in Wisconsin for many, many years. And to make a very long story short, we felt at the time that that was looked at that it would not increase the number of organ donations. And so the decision was is to simply allow people to opt in, to go to the registry, go to the Department of Motor Vehicle, and indicate your wishes there. I'll also say around Wisconsin, I know your previous guest asked about donation rates in Wisconsin and how we compare to other states. We rate very high compared to other states. We have some of the highest donation rates throughout the country. And again, I think that is primarily because we have a good system in place. We generally have very good trust of the medical system throughout our state. And at the end of the day, folks in Wisconsin are very, very generous.
And do you chalk that up in part two to education efforts like things you might be doing this month to get the word out?
Yeah, obviously your previous guest also brought this up, but we're celebrating Donate Life Month. That is something we do every April. It started in 2003, and that's really an opportunity for us to promote organ, tissue, and eye donation as well as celebrate the lives of those that have generously given organ transplants at the end of their life.
Let's go to another caller. We've got Michelle on the line in Green Bay. Michelle, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share, as long as you're talking about advocacy for organ donation, our own story. And I think that sometimes it helps people to understand where the process ends up. When my daughter was 6 years old, she went into heart failure inexplicably, it was unrecoverable, and her only option was a transplant, which she received in June of 2012. And, you know, as many times as I think about that family, we never had the chance to meet them, although we would love to, and think about that decision that they made to donate organs. And, you know, it's hard to think about, but in that case, it had to be somebody of at least small size, if not young age, that could donate a heart that my daughter could receive. And to think of a family being that generous to make that decision to save somebody else's life is pretty incredible. And as a matter of fact, in that same year, a cousin of my father's donated a kidney as part of a chain to help his wife receive a kidney that she needed. Nobody in their family was a match, but they were able to be a part of a chain to get her the kidney that she needed to survive. So as a result, we are all part of advocating for registering as a donor and understanding how the process works and hopefully helping others that are on that waiting list.
Michelle, thank you so much for calling and sharing those stories. And that's got to be the ultimate advocacy. Michelle's daughter is alive because another family made this decision.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe what I'd like to share with you, and I know we have a very short time, but a lot of people ask me, how do donor families feel about the donation after the donation? And I'd like to read to you a very, very brief letter. And it says here, "Dear recipient, it is with both great sadness and great joy that I am reaching out to you with this letter. I am overwhelmingly saddened at the loss of my beloved wife over 5 months ago. However, I am filled with tremendous joy knowing that she was able to give a little of herself to ensure a better and longer life for someone else. As the good and giving person she was, she would rejoice knowing that she could share the gift of a better life with you. Please know that it has given all of her family great consolation knowing that this caring, generous, and loved woman was able to help you in your time of need. We all hope that any future date we might be able to meet you and your loving family."
Wow. That's an amazing letter. Just a few moments left, Mike. Is there a good resource you would point people toward to get more facts? And then again, remind us how to sign up here to be an organ donor.
Yeah. If you go to yesiwillwisconsin.com, there's a fact list there, and you can sign up at the same time. And to sign up to be a registered donor takes about 3 minutes.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for coming up here today.
Thank you.
That's Mike Anderson. He's director of University of Wisconsin Organ and Tissue Donation Services, with us to talk about efforts this month, Give Life Month, Donate Life Month, to talk about organ donation here in Wisconsin. Science news out this week. The Brontosaurus is making a comeback, not literally in a Jurassic Park kind of way, not yet anyway.
But the Brontosaurus may be getting back its old spot in the dinosaur family tree after a new study took a close look at lots and lots of specimens.
The history in a very small nutshell: early fossil hunters classified two separate related genuses, Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus. Apatosaurus? Never remember that one.
I think it's Apatosaurus. But I could be wrong.
But then on closer inspection, many paleontologists said, nope, no Brontosaurus, just one genus after all. But the big, cuddly Brontosaurus lived on in our public imagination.
And on even closer inspection, this new 300-page study says there's enough evidence to bring the Brontosaurus back as its own standalone genus as part of a long-running effort to untangle the dinosaur family tree. Great news for kids who still have those plastic Brontosaurus toys.
Yeah, I think I like this. You know, I'm not an expert on the subject, but when I think Brontosaurus, a picture comes into my mind of, you know, that big guy, thin on one end, thin on the other, big in the middle.
From the Flintstones.
Right. Apatosaurus, I have to think, oh, that's the one that's kind of like a Brontosaurus, and that's what it really is. So, okay, I am down with this.
You're on board.
If they ask me, which they haven't.
Well, as a tribute to everyone involved in this effort, we go to the news with They Might Be Giants, and I Am a Paleontologist. You're on Central Time.
Could it be an herbivore, crushing plants with rounded teeth, or ferocious carnivore who moves so quickly on its feet? It's like pieces of a puzzle that I love to try and